This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to cover a story that is of utmost importance. It has to do with the benefits of mushrooms, dietary mushrooms, medicinal mushrooms. We're going to talk to an expert, Dr. Robert Beilman, in the wake of a study in which researchers found that mushrooms have high amounts of key antioxidants that may have anti-aging potential. Dr. Beilman is Professor Emeritus of Food Science and Director of the Penn State Center for Plant and Mushroom Products for Health. So that is a unique center. First of all, welcome, Dr. Beilman. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what is the center all about? I mean, what is it that you do there? You study mushrooms and other plants in terms of their health potential?
Well, yeah, that's the idea, that because of the, greater interest in the plant-based diet, and the fact that I taught, the course here in our food science department for 40 years or more on plant products, plant food products, it's an area that I have interest in and that I think needs to be emphasized more. And I started the center when I retired, 7 years ago. And basically, I retired from teaching and meetings because I'm still sitting in my office overlooking Mount Nittany as we speak, and I'm here pretty much every day. And I'm interested in keeping research going in this this area of plant and mushroom products for health.
Indeed. So the most recent discovery. Tell us about that. These are two dietary antioxidants that have great practical import for human health that can be found in mushrooms. What was it that you uncovered?
Well, this study came about because I was at a meeting, actually in Amsterdam, when I ran into a colleague named Dr. John Ritchie, who's at our medical school, which is in Hershey. It's 100 miles away from the main campus here, so we didn't know each other existed. But he's an expert on glutathione, and we worked on ergothionine in mushrooms, and we decided there we would try to do a study to measure both of them in a broader spectrum of mushroom types.
So ergothionine is a related compound?
Well, actually, they do share somewhat the same metabolic pathway, and they're both, antioxidants that function in the body. There's a lot more known about glutathione and its function because it's all living organisms actually make it, and it's often called the master antioxidant. And so it's been studied very widely. It was around 2005 when a colleague here that's a biochemistry professor who's now also retired told me about ergothionine, and he worked with bacteria that was involved in the metabolism that he was studying, and he thought, one should look into see if it's in mushrooms since we think fungi are the main producers of it. So we did that. A graduate student of mine, Joy Dubot, did the work, and we worked with about five or six different mushrooms at that time, and worked out a method to measure the ergothionine, and then actually calculated in these various mushrooms. And we did some studies to see if we could increase it in the common button mushroom, during its growth, and we really didn't succeed very much there. So anyway, and then
yeah, it would be nice to figure out a way to amp it up in some way through some perhaps offering it a certain type of fertilizer or through some natural intervention, temperature or something like that, or sunlight.
Right.
Presumably those are the lines that you went down.
Well, yeah, we did try adding some of the precursors to the substrate that the mushrooms grow in, and we got some slight effects, but not very much. We do know that that the ergothionine level in the button mushroom increases with the flush of the crop cycle. In other words, when mushrooms grow, they produce a large amount of mushrooms, and that's called the first flush, and they're picked off, and then the substrate's watered again, and then a second flush comes up, which is usually smaller, and it's about a week in between, and then they pick that off, and in some cases they go to three flushes, again, the crop diminishes, but what we found was the ergothionine level increased, especially in the third flush, and that kind of led us to believe that maybe ergothionine is a stress metabolite, because the mushrooms are under more stress the longer the crop goes on because of lack of nutrients, lack of water, buildup of toxins, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that seems to parallel what happens with other plant species, because there's this phenomenon of, I believe it's called phytoalexins, which are compounds that plants elaborate in relationship to stress. That's why you want your wine grapes to be a little stressed, maybe a little heat, slight drought, but you know, nothing too good, maybe a cold nip, and then it seems to make a more robust tasting wine, but also the taste is a signature for the presence of these beneficial compounds.
Right. You know, I used to teach wine appreciation here, and I used to tell the students the adage that is often used, a struggling vine makes the best wine.
Very good. Yeah. So, okay. So in your article in a recent issue of Food Chemistry, you looked at several species of mushrooms. So for our listeners who, want news they can use in terms of obtaining the full benefits of these antioxidants, is it some esoteric species of mushroom that is most likely to deliver, or is it ordinary supermarket variety button mushrooms that can provide adequate amounts?
Well, unfortunately, the button mushroom makes the least amount.
Okay.
However, it's still much more than you find in any other food. So they're still a good source of ergothionine. But a lot of the so-called specialty mushrooms like shiitake and oyster, maitake, produce significantly more ergothionine. And we also did measure Ganoderma, which is often used in Asian medicine, everything,
and
that was not particularly high. But the one we did find had the highest amount by almost threefold was the Boletus edulis, which we called a porcini. It's a common name.
Okay.
And
that's a culinary
unfortunately
mushroom.
they can't be cultivated, so they have to be found in the wild, which kind of reduces the good aspect of that.
Kind of like truffles.
Right, exactly.
You can't grow them even in your with your exacting food technology that you've probably been studying for decades. So all right, so this is interesting. Now, one of the things that I learned fairly recently about mushrooms is that mushrooms, like humans, can get a suntan, and under the influence of ultraviolet, they produce vitamin D. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, that's right. Mushrooms have in their membranes a compound called ergosterol, which is almost exactly the same as the compound called cholesterol, which is what we have in our membranes. And when UV light strikes cholesterol, in our skin, it produces vitamin D, which we call vitamin D3. When you irradiate mushrooms with UV light or expose them to sunlight, they convert the ergosterol to vitamin D2. And it would take an expert to really know the difference when you look at the structures of them, and they are fairly interchangeable.
Okay, so is this the way that vitamin D2 is produced commercially? Because we know that the vitamin D3, which some people think may be more bioavailable, that's a byproduct of lanolin, which is from wool production.
Right. Most of the vitamin D2, especially like the pharmaceutical grade material and everything, is produced by exposing yeast to ultraviolet light. And of course, they are fungi, and they have ergosterol in their membranes, and then they extract it from the yeast. We actually have done a lot of work on vitamin D2 as well, and one of my graduate students, Michael Kolaris, and I are authors of a patent which the university owns on producing vitamin D2 very rapidly and predictably in mushrooms.
So, does it pay for consumers to get their commercial mushrooms and then put them out on the windowsill and let them get exposed to a little bit of sunlight? Will it actually bump up their vitamin D content?
Yeah, yes, it will. If you leave them out, 30 minutes to an hour or maybe 2 hours, but you can't leave them inside the windows tend to take out the UV rays.
Right.
So there's a lot, a fair amount of work that's been done on just exposing mushrooms to sunlight. And of course, in the wild, that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the wild mushrooms have natural vitamin D in them.
So is it advisable for people to go out in the forest and that looks appealing, and I'll just grab a basket of mushrooms and take them home and saute them up?
Well, I'm very cautious about that because the only wild mushrooms that I would even eat myself would be the morels, because nothing else looks like them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm not really an expert in identifying wild mushrooms, so I stay away from that and recommend most people to do that. As some wise man said, well, if they're toxic, you'll know in a half an hour.
Yeah, and you'll be on your way to the liver transplant unit.
Right.
Because, that's the so-called Amanita death angel mushroom, which is responsible for hepatic necrosis. And it really, every year there are a few cases of people who either die or require liver transplantation because they stray off the path and gather the wrong mushrooms. It's not too hard to misidentify them.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the other properties of mushrooms, because you're a mushroom maven. You've written quite a few papers on that subject. One that intrigues me is a paper that you wrote back, last year. It was a retrospective study in adults with metabolic syndrome, diabetic risk factor response to daily consumption of Agaricus bisporus, which is a white button mushroom. That's pretty cool. Is there some implication for diabetics that perhaps including mushrooms in their diet is a good thing?
Well, that was the intent of the study. You notice that the paper you're referring to calls a retrospective study, so that means we did it after the fact. The original study was to look at vitamin D-enriched mushrooms as a way of increasing the vitamin D levels of people that were deficient. And this was done in New York City with people that actually came into dialysis clinic there. But the lead author on that was he's a nephrologist. Anyway, but that experiment didn't work for, we didn't really get results that showed us much. So, in talking, later about the study, we realized we had some blood samples left over from all these people. They've been stored, in minus 80 C, and they were stable. So we decided to say, well, let's see what the ergothionine levels were in these people, and whether it had an effect on their health. So that's why it's retrospective. It was done after the fact. And this study was done with white button mushrooms because it was funded by the Mushroom Council, which does work to try to improve and increase the sales of U.S. mushrooms, fresh mushrooms, and most of those are button mushrooms. So What we did find, though, and of course these people, we took all the people that consumed mushrooms, I think it was 40 or so, and their blood was taken before they started eating the mushrooms, and after 16 weeks of eating 100 grams of mushrooms a day, which is the normal serving size, at least in Europe, our normal serving size, according to the USDA, is 3 ounces, which is like 85 grams. But anyway, we used 100 grams, and what we found is after the 16 weeks, the ergothionine level in the plasma of the average, these people, doubled over the 16 weeks. And then we also took their blood 4 weeks after they went off of the mushrooms, and we had those samples, and the levels declined significantly back towards normal. And then we looked at a lot of biomarkers of disease and whatever, especially of oxidative stress and that kind of thing. And we found that the levels of a number of these went down as the ergothionine level went up in the blood, and then went the other direction after they went off the. So it gave us an indication that this would be a great area for further study, and that's one of my goals, is to try to find collaboration and the funds to do another, you know, placebo-controlled random human clinical trial using mushrooms, and maybe look at other other diseases, which I think would be more that would show more effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so why are we extrapolating that the higher levels of these things might have an anti-aging effect? Where's the precedent for that?
Okay, well, the way I came up with that is that there was a study done in Singapore by Barry Halliwell's group, who's the world's leading expert in the area of free radicals and antioxidants and aging. And he showed that as people aged, the ergothionine level in their blood went down significantly. And then he divided the people into groups, that those that had mild cognitive impairment and those that did not. And he found that the people that had the higher levels as they aged of ergothionine in their blood had less cognitive impairment. So he indicated that maybe there's something here in regard to levels of ergothionine in our bodies, especially our blood, might protect us from neurodegenerative diseases. So I took that to say this is an area to look into. Also, there was a study about the same time where they looked at patients that had Parkinson's disease with age-matched people that did not, and the people with Parkinson's disease had lower levels of ergothionine significantly than those that did not. So that's the basis for that. So one day I'm sitting in my office having time to think, because I'm not going to meetings or teaching, and I saw that there was a study done in France where they estimated the ergothionine consumption in people in five countries. And they were U.S., Finland, France, Ireland, and Italy. And so I took their data and calculated how much ergothionine would be, based on their estimate, would be consumed per day by the average individual. Somebody that weighs 150 pounds is usually used. And I did that, and what I found was is that the U.S. had the lowest ergothionine in their blood.
Predictably, yeah.
And 1.1 milligrams, or I mean, excuse me, not in their blood, estimated consumption per day, 1.1 milligram. Finland was 1.3, France was 2.2, Ireland was 3.6, and Italy was 4.6.
Mm-hmm.
So then I said, well, you know, if this has an effect on potentially on neurological disease, I wonder if I can find data on, for example, incidences of these various diseases. I found data, worldwide data, on you can find on the internet for death rates caused by, for example, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and MS. And what you see then when you plot the curve, you know, putting the effective number of deaths per 100,000 by the disease versus the ergothionine consumption estimated, you find that the countries like Finland and the U.S. have by far the higher rates of those, and it goes down, and Italy has the least. And it's almost, a beautiful sort of sloped curve for both Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, and MS. So I think that we're onto something there. I think that there is something going on that increasing the ergothionine level in the diet would perhaps mitigate some of these diseases.
So we're on our way to saying that mushrooms could be brain food if we want to kind of boil it down.
Exactly. I developed a bread by taking mushroom powders from some of these high ergothionine mushrooms, making powder out of it, putting it into whole wheat bread. I had a small bakery here make it for me, and we called it Brain Boost Bread.
There you go.
And but anyway, doing that, we figured out a way to get like 1 milligram of ergothionine in a slice of this bread. And so what I'm promoting is that I think people should be on average eating 3 milligrams a day more ergothionine than they are now.
And that would bring us what would it take to achieve that? Just in terms of American measurements, like a cup-wise of raw mushrooms. And of course, they tend to condense, and if you saute them, they saute down to almost nothing.
You're right. Well, I figured that out. In that study where we fed people 100 grams a day, it turns out that if in 100 grams of button mushrooms, on average, there would be about 3.2 milligrams of ergothionine. So if you ate 100 grams of mushrooms a day, which is a normal serving size in Europe and almost everywhere else in the world, per day, you'd be getting over 3 milligrams of ergothionine.
Which is about a half a cup or a cup of raw mushrooms?
That equates to about 5 medium-sized button mushrooms.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's very attainable. I'm thinking, you have to have a boxcar load of those to attain those levels. No, that's quite feasible.
And then it would equate to about 25 grams of some of these mushrooms like shiitakes and oysters and maitake.
Great. So those are more concentrated, so you'll get...
Right.
Well, I always feel good when I eat mushrooms, and now I know why. that I'm doing myself a real solid, because I know that they're chock full of beneficial nutrients. And you've done the grunt work to find out why. Okay, great. You've laid the groundwork for our discussion in part two. I want to shift gears and talk a little bit about the immune potentiating benefits of mushrooms, with which you're familiar. Today we're talking to a mushroom expert. He is Professor Robert Beilman, Professor Emeritus of Food Science and Director of the Penn State Center for Plant and Mushroom Products for Health. Go Nittany Lions, right?
Right. Go.
Okay, we'll pause, and we'll be right back with part two. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I interject something here?
Sure.
I've actually never done anything myself with the immune properties, enhancing properties, or especially with the, the glucans and whatever, which are usually... mentioned in that realm.
Can you speak to that in part two to some extent? I know that's not your actual personal research, but I think we can cover it basically with a layman's explanation. When we return, more on the subject of mushrooms. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.